Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, the environmental impacts of wind energy.
Basically, marine mammals, whales and dolphins, they must feel by now like they're in a big, busy city where they can't hear each other, they can't find their prey.
Also on today's show, British veterans of nuclear tests in the 50s and 60s win backing to continue their struggle for compensation for the effects of radiation.
You could see the flash so brightly that you could quite clearly make out the bones of your hands.
And we take a trip to a park recently awarded UNESCO World Heritage status here in Germany. Those stories coming up. I'm Nathan Witkop. Welcome to the show. Earlier this week, the Industry Association for Wind Energy in Europe released a report on its expectations for growth in the sector over the next two decades. According to one of its scenarios, Europe's output of wind energy could triple from today's level of about 86 gigawatts to 230 gigawatts in the next 10 years. That would be around the same amount of power that coal supplies the EU today. However, a lot of this investment is conditional on the continued support of feed-in tariffs that have seen wind energy boom in Germany over the last decade. It's also conditional on a pickup in offshore wind parks as space on land dries up and local resistance to land-based turbines mounts. Andy Valver takes this look at the situation in Germany, a driving force in wind energy in Europe.
Germany has decided to abandon nuclear energy, and by the year 2030, wind is expected to more than make up for this source of power. With terrestrial wind capacity already pushing its limits, most wind energy in the future is expected to come from offshore. Yet, Germany lags behind other countries like Britain when it comes to these investments. Despite being one of Europe's leading wind producers, it has built just two offshore parks to date. Hermann Albers, the head of Germany's Wind Energy Association, says Berlin's flip-flopping on energy policy has weakened the investment climate.
Whoever decides to return to nuclear energy then abandons this policy, but then starts talking about restricting support for renewable energies. They are not doing our industry any favors.
Albers was referring to the government's initial idea of sharply reducing the feed-in tariffs for renewable energies, an idea it dropped from this year's energy bill, which now eases planning requirements for wind parks. On top of this, Berlin has cleared the way for Germany's state-backed development bank to provide 5 billion euros worth of cheap credit for at least 10 offshore projects. Chancellor Angela Merkel is betting that wind will provide the lion's share of the renewable energies that she hopes will supply half the grid by 2030.
The focus should be on expanding wind on land and at sea.
At sea, the wind often blows more strongly and predictably. There are also fewer possibilities for conflicts with locals. But wind parks are still far cheaper to build on land, where they are nearly half as expensive. Last year, Germany's 22,000 wind turbines supplied about 6% of the country's electricity. Almost all of them are on land. But as the number and size of wind turbines grows in Germany, so too does resistance to these things. Some turbines can now reach heights of 200 meters, tall enough to locate them within forests, and this horrifies some people who have to live close by. Jana Radant is the head of a citizens' initiative in a place called Wandlitz, close to Berlin.
The citizens' initiative isn't opposed to wind turbines as such. It's against turbines in high conservation value forests. Wandlitz has a lot of forest cover. Much of it is beech forest, of which there's very little left in Germany.
According to Germany's Wind Energy Association, roughly 2% of the country is suitable for wind turbines, which it says could one day supply up to two-thirds of the nation's electricity. Whether people will allow this to happen or not is another matter. Government may prefer to avoid conflicts by locating more turbines at sea, but for the moment, industry seems to prefer investing on land because it's cheaper.
Andy Valver with that report. Now, as well as aesthetic concerns about wind parks' disruption of natural landscapes, there are also environmental concerns, and not just on land. This is the recording of the construction of an offshore wind park. It's the sound of pile driving to secure a turbine to the seafloor. It was recorded some 17 kilometres from its source. This is the sound at a distance of 46 kilometres. Needless to say, these noises are bad news for whales and dolphins that need to communicate long distances underwater and are particularly sensitive to noise. So to talk more about the environmental impacts of a technology whose main purpose is to make energy greener, we spoke to a specialist in migratory species who recently took part in a meeting in South Africa aimed at making wind energy more ecologically friendly.
Hi, my name is Aline Kuhl. I'm working for the Convention on Migratory Species, which is an agreement under the United Nations Environment Programme. And I'm in the science unit, and I'm associate scientific and technical officer there.
How about offshore parks? How do they compare to onshore parks in terms of their environmental impact? Are they a lot better because they're far away from the places where birds like to go?
If you look at total wind power installed at the moment, which is about 200,000 megawatts, which is about two times the capacity of all the German power plants, then less than 2% of this are offshore constructions. This will grow in the coming years, but really right now we don't know that well what the impacts will be. One of the things that's clear is ocean noise. So this is what it really adds compared to the onshore wind turbines.
But this is mainly in the construction phase, right? So I guess that's a limited period of time in which there's this drilling going on?
It appears that it's mostly a construction issue. If you use something like pile driving, which is essentially like hammering a huge big nail into the seabed floor, and this is not only a problem in terms of intensity, the sheer noise of it, but also the frequency. Basically, marine mammals, whales and dolphins, they must feel by now that they're in a big busy city where they can't hear each other, they can't find their prey and such problems. But you're right, once the wind farm is built, this is probably less of a problem. So we should try and avoid this noise during construction. And that's why we need more research.
And I don't want to exaggerate perhaps the benefits of this kind of technology here. I take it that every form of energy generation has some kind of impact. But I was surprised to read that there are potential benefits to be had in terms of promoting perhaps reefs on the seafloor. Is that true? Are there beneficial side effects from installing wind turbines at sea?
Yes, there are definitely benefits, such as, you know, having structures where you could have small, odd metal reefs. But I think most importantly, you create a kind of marine protected area, because fishermen will be reluctant to fish in those areas. One, it's generally not permitted, but two, they might also avoid going there because they might have their nets caught and so on. I mean, the problem with birds and also migratory bats remains up in the air.
Do we have any general statistics about how many birds are killed by wind parks each year?
We have very few general ones. There are plenty of case studies around, and the overall message is that there isn't a general overall figure of how many birds are killed by wind farms. It really depends on where you put your wind farm.
Are we talking about hundreds? Are we talking about thousands of birds killed a year on a global level?
We're certainly talking about hundreds of thousands, so maybe even up to a million, but it really depends on where you put your wind farm. In some sites, there are figures showing that per megawatt installed, about three birds are killed, but I personally find it's not so meaningful to look at the numbers of birds, but to look at what kind of bird is being killed. So is it a slow reproducing endangered species? Then we've got a problem. If it is something that's very common and not endangered, then it might not be a problem.
How do wind parks or wind turbines stack up against other human created buildings, or even like traffic or other forms of energy? Is it a relatively big killer of birds, or how would you put it compared to these other things?
It can be a big killer in a certain location, but generally, overall, globally, it's a low-impact industry when you compare it to buildings, for example, or to, there's an interesting study, for example, which suggests that cats kill more birds than wind farms. Or you look at, you know, habitat destruction. It's on a totally different scale that we're talking here. And the good news is that if you put a wind farm in the right place and you think carefully about it, you monitor also after construction, think carefully about the design, it can be perfectly, you know, bird friendly.
Okay, but I guess the big concern is that the industry is really starting to take off, and these kinds of issues have to be nipped in the bud before we start building wind farms willy-nilly.
That's right, and that's especially the case when you look at offshore construction. So in Northern Europe, especially at the moment, there's a hell of a lot of constructions in the North Sea, and we don't really know what the problems might be in the long term.
One of the interesting things which I was reading about before we did this interview was that bats seem to be threatened more by wind parks than birds in general.
Yes, I think if people take one thing from this interview, I think then that's the big news, that bats have been much neglected and they are seriously affected by wind farms. And because they're so small and difficult to see, they fly at night, this is only starting to hit the agenda now. And the trouble is that they don't just get killed when they actually hit a turbine, but they get something called barotrauma. They've got relatively flexible, soft lungs, and when they hit this air pressure zone close to the blade, their lungs collapse and they get internal bleedings. And about 50% of the bats that you find, they look perfectly fine. They're dead and look fine, but they've had this barotrauma with internal bleedings.
So their lungs more or less
collapse
just because they've been flying very close to the spinning of the turbine.
That's right.
And strangely, they tend to be attracted to wind parks. Do we know why?
There's some studies on this, not many. Some of these suggest that especially insect feeding bats are affected, and sometimes at low wind speeds, insects collect around the turbine and then these bats come and try and eat these clouds of insects. But really, the jury is still out there. There might be many, many other reasons, so we have to do much more research on this.
And before, you mentioned particular species of birds that tend to be more threatened, and that it's a concern when perhaps a threatened species is disproportionately affected by wind parks. What types of birds are disproportionately affected?
Some of these are, for example, birds of prey, large raptors, soaring birds that also depend on the uplift. They can't maneuver so well, so they're basically on this spiraling upward channel, and they can't, if there's a wind farm in the way, they might just hit it. Also, if you've got birds of prey, they're basically looking down at the ground trying to catch a rabbit. They're not focusing at what they actually, the space ahead where they're flying into. Then also seabirds, grassland birds, and last but not least, migratory species, of course, which we're concerned at the Convention of Migratory Species, because you tend to get large flocks arriving. And if these hit a wind farm, there can be very large mortalities at one site. So if you put a wind farm in the middle of a migratory species corridor, like the Strait of Gibraltar or something, that could be a potential problem.
How much flexibility is there in terms of relocating wind parks? Because already, obviously, you've got to take into the consideration where the wind's blowing. That's not always the same place as where the urban centres are. If you start to factor in considerations of where migratory species might be flying through, you're starting to add a lot of variables. Is this going to drastically reduce the number of locations where wind parks really can be located?
If you're looking at a country like Germany, which is quite built up, then it is going to be more difficult than in a developing country, for example, where there is much will now to build more wind farms, and there's actually a surprising amount of choice. The key message, which is the same for whichever country you're looking at, is to do mapping and do zoning maps and looking exactly at where's your wind, but also where are my endangered species, where are my migratory corridors, where might I have a sensitive wetland, breeding areas, and overlapping these. So you end up with a green area, for example, which is free for energy construction. You might have an orange one where you need to check. You might need some more research being conducted, and some red ones, which are no-go areas for construction.
One of the other words that jumped out at me in the report that I was reading beforehand was this idea of conservation offset mechanisms. I mean, this sounds like horrible UN jargon to me, but what is this? It sounds like it's fine to kill things here as long as you save more things over there. Is that right?
This, I should say at the onset, only works for some species. So for migratory species, it does not work. But if you are looking, for example, at something like a desert tortoise, there's a case, for example, with a solar farm in California. So they're building a solar farm and there's this endangered desert tortoise and they're assisting its breeding and setting aside habitats elsewhere, which is then specially protected. So for such a kind of species, this might work. But if you're talking about a raptor, I mean, you can't move them. Yeah, it's really a case-by-case decision.
That was Aline Kuhl, a scientific officer with the United Nations Environment Programme. And a reminder, you're listening to Deutsche Welle's Living Planet, coming to you from Bonn in Germany. Time now for a quick look at some environment news from the past week. Here's Sean Sinico.
Eco News.
A study of three Himalayan glaciers found this week that they've been shrinking for the past 40 years and that the rate of melting accelerated over the last decade. The findings were published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. One of the study's authors told Reuters that two of the glaciers, located in Nepal, would disappear, but he added his team did not have the data to pinpoint when this would happen. Himalayan glaciers are an important source of water for many people living in Asia. A Malaysian newspaper reported this week that the country is planning a national certification scheme for palm oil. If it goes ahead, the scheme would rival the world's main standard aimed at reducing the industry's environmental impact. The Malaysian Business Times quoted the country's commodities minister as saying his government was dissatisfied with the roundtable on sustainable palm oil because it kept changing the goalposts. He indicated a national scheme would be more business-friendly. Malaysia is the world's second biggest producer of palm oil after Indonesia. Reuters reports that Cameroon and Chad have signed an accord to clamp down on poachers on their common border. The two countries will boost cooperation and the number of armed rangers patrolling a 300,000-hectare protected area in their territory. Poachers kill hundreds of elephants and other animals in the two countries each year, mainly to sell ivory to Asian markets. Chad's environment minister said poachers had reduced his country's elephant population from 5,000 to 3,000 in the last 5 years. Japan's government says it intends to dismiss three top energy officials in an overhaul brought about by the country's nuclear disaster. The replacements all target officials in the economy ministry, which has until now overseen nuclear regulation. The announcement follows criticism that senior bureaucrats have sought to influence public opinion in the wake of the Fukushima nuclear disaster by getting staff to send emails in support of nuclear power to a public forum. Pockets of lethal levels of radiation, measuring 10,000 millisieverts an hour, were discovered to persist at the Fukushima plant this week, nearly 5 months after the accident.
Sean Sinico there with the environment news. From radiation in Japan now to fallout in Britain, or at least of a sort. The UK government is fighting the prospect of a multi-million euro compensation claim with British military veterans who witnessed nuclear test explosions in the 1950s and 60s. Medics say many of them have developed severe health problems like cancer as a result of radiation. Last Thursday, the UK's Supreme Court granted veterans the right to proceed with their appeal for damages, which could come in at more than 30 million euros. Lars Bevanga met one of the veterans and filed this report from Northern England.
I looked out of the window and there was a huge tent. It had a poster across it that said Christmas Island Airways. And nobody was wearing anything other than a pair of shorts and a pair of sandals.
Brian Leake was 18 when, as a soldier, he arrived in 1958 at one of the UK's bases for nuclear tests on Christmas Island in the mid-Pacific. While he was there, he witnessed four tests, three mid-air explosions and one on the island itself.
They said, turn and face away from ground zero, raise the collar of your shirt, roll down your sleeves, sit down on the ground, close your eyes.
Minus 40 seconds. Close eyes.
Cover your closed eyes with the palms of your hands. The speaker said, the weapon has now left the aircraft.
Five, four, three.
And the countdown started. Five, four, three, two, one. Flash. You could see the flash so brightly that you could quite clearly make out the bones of your hands.
Brian Leake is now 72, and since his Christmas Island posting, he's developed four separate cancers. He's one of more than 1,000 veterans who say their illness stems from radiation and who are now fighting the UK government for compensation. They want it to set up a €34 million fund to be shared out to survivors. But the government says there's not enough evidence of a link between the radiation they suffered and their illness.
Well, we've been able to show that the island was contaminated. The island is still contaminated.
Suzanne Roth disagrees. She's a researcher at the Dundee School of Medicine in Scotland and has gathered data on many of the British nuclear veterans.
They could have absorbed or ingested radionuclides from the food that they ate, from the sea or the coconuts on the land. They could have got it from the very sand that they walked on. And we've proved that several times in the Pensions Appeals Tribunal to the satisfaction of the medical member of the committee and to the legal member of the committee that this is a reasonable possibility.
All the main Western nuclear powers, including the US, Australia and France, have paid various degrees of compensation to their nuclear test veterans. On Thursday, the UK Supreme Court hears the UK veterans' challenge to an earlier ruling barring them from claiming compensation. If they win, the government faces potential compensation claims running into tens of millions of euro.
That's the group of people that I worked with.
Right. And where were you?
I'm there, looking down.
Flicking through his Christmas Island photos, Brian Leake says he's angered by the government's apparent reluctance to admit he and his colleagues might have been exposed to unhealthy doses of radiation. The Minister of Defence could not provide an interview but issued a statement saying there is no evidence of excess illness or mortality amongst the veterans as a group, which could be linked to their participation in the tests or to exposure to radiation as a result of that participation. For Brian Leake, though, money is not the main issue.
The police said, well, we were sorry. We slipped up, but we can't afford to pay you compensation. Then that would be something else. But they can't even do that. They can't even apologise.
Lars Bevanger, Deutsche Welle Radio, in the town of Burntwood, near Birmingham in the English Midlands.
Finally, today we're going to take a trip to the park. Kellerwald-Edersee National Park is one of the five beechwood forests recently declared UNESCO World Heritage Sites here in Germany. This puts them on a list that includes the Grand Canyon, the Great Barrier Reef and the Galapagos Islands. With around 60% beechwood, Kellerwald-Edersee is one of the last remaining natural red beech forests in Europe. But, and I'm tempted to insert a pun here, a forest isn't just its trees. It's also the wildlife, which lives interdependently within it. That's why the Park Service is trying to repopulate part of the forest with its original animal species. Chiponda Cimbelu went along to take a look.
Ja, meine Damen und Herren, liebe Kinder, herzlich willkommen hier bei uns im Wildpark Edersee zu unserer Themenführung Wildpark bei Nacht.
It's 8:30 p.m. and Ranger Albert Hernold has started his evening tour of Kellerwald-Edersee Wildlife Park. Here, 16 kinds of animals live in a large enclosure of about 1 square kilometer. Kellerwald-Edersee is repopulating the animal park with species that once lived in Europe's forests before human interference to interest especially children in this very special habitat. The tour begins with a visit to a shallow pond with a tree trunk in the middle.
Die hellere ist das Fienchen und. Fienchen.
Schmeck an.
This is where the four otters live. Earlier today, Hernold made sure they'll put in an appearance later.
Yes, normally we feed them two times a day at 12:30 and 16:15. But today, when we have this Wildpark bei Nacht, we give them only 2 or 3 fishes, so they are hungry, and perhaps when we have luck, they come at this time and we can see them.
The hungry otters put in an appearance and they are eager for a second helping. As they tear up the raw fish, Hernold tells the visitors how European otters, which lived here at the turn of the century, were virtually hunted out of existence in this area. They still exist in other parts of Europe, but these otters are actually a Canadian species, introduced in the Kellerwald Park because they are more resilient to disease. This year, the otters, Otto and Finchen, have produced two babies.
Ich habe, wie gesagt, Urlaub gehabt. Ich habe es noch nicht gesagt. Das muss irgendwie schon Nationalparkamt mitgeteilt. Ich glaube, Poldi und Paulinchen oder sowas haben sich die Leser.
The children want to know what the young otters are called. Paulina and Poldi were the names chosen by the readers of a local newspaper. The ranger tells them.
Was machen die? Die heulen den Mond an.
Once upon a time, before they were hunted out by humans, wolves roamed this forest. Conservationists are keen to reintroduce wolves to their natural habitat in many parts of Europe. But this often meets with opposition from farmers. These have been brought into the park and are one of its most popular attractions. But despite all the impressive howling, the wolf isn't the king of this forest. That honor goes to the giant, furry, fierce-looking, cattle-like creatures lurking in the shadows. The European bison is the continent's largest surviving land animal. And the ones in this park are kept in an extremely secure enclosure because they can attack humans if they feel threatened. But the children soon find out that the forest isn't only home to spectacular animals. Wildcats, which don't look all too different from domestic ones and can be hard to spot, are also part of the show. The park had planned to build a large enclosure for the wildcats with all modkins, including computerized feeding, Hernold tells the group. But that would have cost 250,000 euros, money that wasn't available. Hernold is hoping that the recognition of the park as a World Heritage Site will result in more money, especially from the European Union.
I think perhaps 2 or 3 years, many visitors come to us and visit the National Park and the Wild Park, which belongs to the National Park. But I think it's not next week or next month. It will be 2 or 3 years before the visitors come.
As the group moves on, he says that money isn't the only challenge. The animals have to coexist with the trees which have earned this park its World Heritage status. Often, male deer or bucks which roam the area freely rub their antlers against the trees to attract females and mark their territory. The damage they can cause can even kill a tree. So the rangers have to treat the damaged bark or fence trees in. The children and the parents seem very satisfied with the animal tour. And Kellerwald-Edersee National Park is a step closer to its goal, that every school-going child in the northern part of the state of Hesse should visit it at least once to learn about the beech forest and its inhabitants. Cipona Cimbelu, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Why do you whisper green grass? Why tell the trees what ain't so? Whispering.
And that's all for now. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this week's show. If you're looking for more of our environment content, come check out our webpage. That's dwworld.de/environment. Till next week, I'm Nathan Whitcop. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Who kissed there long ago? Whispering grass, the trees don't need to know. Don't you tell it to the breeze, 'cause she will tell the birds and bees, and everyone will know, because you've told the blabbering trees. Yes, you've told them once before. It's no secret anymore. Why tell them all the old things? They're buried under the snow. Whispering grass, don't tell the trees, 'cause the trees don't need to know.